It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mod Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome back, listeners, to your favorite half hour of old-time hunting, fishing, and trapping stories. This is the program we call Alaska Tracks, where we share excerpts from oral history interviews recorded with veteran outdoorsmen. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'll be your host. Today, we continue with our interview of Adam Greenwald of Hoonah. Last week, we heard some really good stories of Adam's early years. In today's episode, Adam tells us about his adventures and accomplishments as an adult. Well, enough of me talking. Let's listen to Adam. In this first segment, he talks about time on the water.
One of the scariest time I ever had, and I had several of them, trapping in the middle of the winter. One time I had a trap line in Port Frederick Air run from South Bight to Chimney Rock, which sort of runs 90 degrees from the rest of the bay. It's a point that sticks out. And I had a trap line there of mostly mink, and I had a few marten traps. But the weather was so bad, it was blowing northerly wind for a week or 10 days, straight up Port Frederick, and it just pounds on that shore, and there was no way I could even get up with my skiff, and it was bitter down in the teens. And so after about a 10-day stretch, the wind died down one day, and it turned calm and beautiful out, and I told Esther, my wife, I said, I'm going to run up, and I'm going to see if I can get in and check that trap line. So when I ran up there, there was still a surf washing on the beach along there. So I run out around the other side of Chimney Rock, which is a little bite there and a nice sand beach, and I anchored my skiff out and I put my pack sack on my back, and I figured I was going to have to spend all day on a trap line that usually takes me maybe an hour to check running with the skiff. I had to hike it. And it was about 2 miles. I had about 30, 40 traps along there, and a lot of them were buried in snow and ice. And I had a number of animals in my trap. And when I got back, it was getting late, sort of getting that evening feeling, getting a little dusky. Got back, the skiff was still out there floating fine. I pulled the skiff in, and it started in to blow more northerly again. I better get in a hurry and get going here before it gets too rough. I can't make it home. So I pulled my skiff in, threw my trap gear in and my pack sack, and I jumped in and started up the motor. And I run in the trough right straight across the bay. I was going to head for Seagull Flat and then run down along the southeast side of the bay, and which is a little more protected. And I got about halfway across Port Frederick. The motor started sort of slowing down. I looked back, and I could see smoke coming out, and I took the cover off the motor real quick, like, and I slowed the motor down just to idle. And I could see it sizzling. It was hotter than a firecracker. So I shut it off, and I kept turning my flywheel so it wouldn't freeze up on the engine. And I kept turning it and turning it, and finally it cooled off enough. I just left the cover off, and I decided, well, I made it from the beach out here. I think I could start up and leave the cover off and make it back to the beach again. So I did. And I made it back to the beach, but it was getting pretty hot. And I got off on the beach. And by that time, it was getting sort of evening, dusky out. So I jerked the motor off the back of the skiff. The north wind started into blowing good again. So I had a 3-pound coffee can for a bailing can in my skiff. I dipped a couple inches of water in it. And then I took and I poured about 2 or 3 cups of gas out of my outboard tank in it. And I threw a match in. I've done it many times to warm my hands. You can put gas in it, it doesn't get enough oxygen to flame up, so it just smudges. Say 2 cups of gas will burn for pretty near 45 minutes, just smudging in there, and you can keep warm on it. And I had set the can up on the beach. I took my toolbox and I jerked the lower unit off the motor, see what was wrong. What happened was, and I know better, but I goofed in my hurry to get to my trap line. When I anchored, I tipped my motor up and pushed the skiff out and anchored it and then took off. Well, it's so cold that the salt water in the water pump, which is on the lower units up out of the water, froze. So when I tipped the motor down and started the engine, it just wiped my impeller out. It froze solid. It was lucky it would have it. It was an old Elgin motor that was handled by Sears Roebuck. And the water pump was a flat piece of pressed tarpaulin cloth and shellac and hardened. Anyhow, it was about an inch wide and about 3 inches long. And it was a slot in my drive shaft that this slid through, and the drive shaft was off center in the pump chamber, so that it made an eccentric. It made the water pump. Well, they just sheared it off, so there was three pieces in there. So I took my trapping hatchet, and I went up and I chopped off a spruce branch, whittled it down. Then I took my hunting knife and I shaved it down. I cut it off so it just fit in the pump lengthways. And then I kept trying it in my shaft, and I kept whittling it down until I got it so it slid through my shaft back and forth. By that time, it was getting pretty dark, but I had this little campfire burning in this three-pound coffee can. But by that time, it was cold, and the north wind was blowing, and I didn't know if I was going to make it home. It was really bad. Put it back together, got on the back of the skiff, and I cranked it up, and the prettiest stream of water you ever seen come out of that back of that motor. So I took off. By the time I got across Port Frederick, it was pitch dark. I knew the shoreline very well and run thousands of times up there. But by the time I got down to Burnt Point, which is about halfway from where I was at to home, I was having to run half speed, and the swell was clicking over top of me, and so I was bailing. If I had taken any grub along, I'd probably pulled in on the lee side of Burnt Point and camped for a while, build a fire. But it was a beautiful day. I was just going to go right up and run back home again. And that didn't happen. But when I made it home, there was ice all over the world. I was knocking ice off. I stopped several times behind islands and took my trapping hatchet and pounded ice off of it. I was just frozen solid. When I got home, she was worried sick. She thought I was dead and gone. But that was one of my scary experiences, and just luck would have it. I had a little luck. The Forest Service is now celebrating their 100th year in Southeast Alaska. In fact, I think in South Central, too, Chugach National Forest and Tongass National Forest. And they're having all their vessels that are still available touring all of Southeast Alaska, and they're going to every port. And I was down the day before yesterday and visited the boat that used to be the Forester, is now named the Sea Bear. And I was on that vessel 58 years ago. The skipper's name was Otter Johnson. And we traveled to all the ports in Southeast Alaska that was either a herring reduction plant, a cannery, or a sawmill that was using water power that was controlled under the U.S. Forest Service. And they had to sign leases and agreements every year. So we went through to all these places and presented them with the new agreements and got their signatures. So I got to see pretty every port in Southeast Alaska.
Yeah, that must have been real interesting just to travel around to all the different places.
Because the lateness of the summer, they asked me if I wouldn't be willing to go on the vessel in Prince William Sound. And the name of it was the Chugach. And that was the biggest boat they had in Alaska. They gave me a six-month contract. They paid my way up there, and they'd pay my way home at the end of the contract. And I got room and board. So I signed the contract, and I went up. I no more got up there in the town of Hoonah. Burnt down. It was in 1944. My folks had a store here then, and their store burnt down. They lost everything, and I couldn't come down because I would have had to pay my own way down. I had this contract signed, so I stayed. But one of my first trips was to Kodiak on an elk count because they transplanted elk from the Olympic Peninsula to Afognak Island. So we had to go up there, and from Cordova, we ran out to Kodiak. We picked up some fish and wildlife agents that did the actual elk count, and we went to Raspberry Straits and a couple other little ports, and I think it was two herds of elk at that time. I can't remember how many elk they counted, but they had increased 8 or 9% from the year before. When we were going to leave Kodiak, and them days you had to clear in and out of port. So we went to clear out of port, and they said, no, you can't leave. And the skipper asked them, well, when can we leave? And they said, we'll notify you. You just go back aboard your vessel, and we'll notify you. And we waited that night and the next day, and he got a little hut around the collar, went up and asked him again, and he said, well, I got to get going. They said, well, you just don't go. We'll tell you when you can go. That afternoon, they came down and said, yeah, you can go, as long as you're going east. You can't go west, but you can go east. Well, we were going east. We were going back to Cordova. We found out afterwards that President Roosevelt was on a convoy and he's cruising the Aleutian Islands. And he was passing Kodiak at the time with the armada that was heading out the Aleutians. But that was deep, dark sea. They didn't tell you any of this. So they just tell you, you stay in port till we tell you you can go. And that was the days that they were transplanting a lot of different animals, and one of them was the marten to Chichikov Island. There was no marten here. And prior to that, it was probably 30 years or so before that, they had planted squirrels on the island with the intention of planting marten, and figured that squirrels would be feed for the marten. And it was probably close to 30 years later they did plant the marten. I don't know the exact date when they first planted them, but it was in the early to mid-40s, and it was in the 50s when we finally opened up a season on that we could take marten. I remember when I got my first marten in the trap, I didn't even know for sure what it was.
And you mentioned something about color variation. They weren't all that uniform at the beginning.
Right. They had sent out bids on marten to trappers. As long as they weren't damaged, they were paying a pretty fair price. Well, they got marten from the interior, they got marten from the coast, and they got marten from different parts of the country. And when they transplanted them, there was quite a variation in color. I caught some of my early marten that was solid orange. The prettiest thing you ever seen. They didn't pay a big price for them, but they were sure a beautiful animal. They settle down now to a pretty uniform color. They're pretty much a dark brown, and the tip of the ears is gray. But when I first started trapping, it was rainbow colors. The worst picture of fur you ever seen. But they did settle down, so now that very seldom get an orange or a different colored marten. I caught one marten, and Norman Goldberg was buying it. In fact, he's sitting right here in my living room, and he was tossing the marten on the floor. He sorted them by size and colors. He took this one and he set it over on the side, and they kept on going through the marten. When he got through, he reached over and grabbed this one marten and he said, "Where did you catch this?" And I couldn't tell you exactly where I caught it, but it was someplace in Port Frederick. And I said, "Why is that?" He says, "In all my furs that I bought in Southeast Alaska, this is the closest I've ever seen to a Russian sable." And he showed it to me, and about every quarter of an inch or so, there was a silver, fine, grayish hair. Didn't notice it until you looked real close. It gives a gloss to it. It was a real dark brown, but it had these little silver hairs all through it. And he says, "That's typical of Russian sable."
Did he give you an extra special price on it?
He gave me a good price on it, but it wasn't a lot more than the rest. That I thought was strange to have one animal out of about 100 of them. And that was the only one ever caught that he said looked typical of Russian sable.
That first boating incident just gives me shivers. To Adam, it was just another day at the office. Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsors. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting this program. Now let's return to more of the history of Southeast Alaska with Adam Greenwald. Now, how about using or marketing your furs? Did you use them yourself for making garments, or did you sell them? And if you sold them, who did you sell to?
When I was a kid, I believe we sold some to Sears Roebuck. They, at that time, bought furs, and then there was fur buyers that came through, and there was a fur buyer that lived here. I sold to many different fur buyers. Later years, Norman Goldberg bought most of my furs. He gave me a pretty good shake, and I shipped some to Canada. The one shipment of furs that I got the biggest price I ever got for any of my fur, it was mostly mink and marten, and I had a few otter in it, but the shipment was missent. It was for months we couldn't find it. It was getting towards spring when they finally found the order of fur, and they were in Honolulu, Hawaii, and they were kept in cold storage. They were kept beautiful. And when they finally got back to the dealer, they called me and they said they received the fur finally, and the fur was in excellent shape, and it wound up that the price of the fur was up quite high. I averaged $45 a piece on my mink. Up to that point, the highest I ever got was $40 for a few extra large ones, and the average was probably closer to $25.
Maybe that delay actually worked to your advantage.
It was to my advantage. It was the best price I ever got for mink. I got better prices for otter later years. It was about 3 years in a row there I got $100 a piece from a large, and I averaged close to $80 a piece on my otter. And I don't imagine you'll get more than maybe a $40 average now.
Now, was Goldberg out of Juneau or Seattle?
Seattle. There was a whole family of Goldbergs. There was a Goldberg building in Seattle. It was just a fur exchange, and they did it tanning. They bought a lot of farm-raised mink and farm-raised fox, and they did all their own tanning. They're still in existence, but the brothers that owned it, they passed on. There was a number of different companies that I dealt with, and I never could find any that was head and shoulders above the others. All pretty close to the same. They were pretty competitive. In fact, I bought for what was about 5 years there.
Was that strictly here in the Hoonah area?
Pretty much so, yeah. I got to meet a lot of fur buyers and fur companies. I spent 4 years on the Board of Fish and Game under Governor Egan.
It was 62 to 65. It was a pretty good board. There was a couple, I thought, that tended to feather their own nest a little bit. But for the most part, I'd say they tried to be honest. We had a lot of hot discussions. We had executive meetings a few times there that there was a few chairs kicked around, you know. When we come out of there, we're all gentlemen, you know, again. They were actually a pretty good group of guys. There was Oscar Dyson from Kodiak and Dr. Romig from Anchorage. There was Gene Miller, an attorney from Fairbanks. Frank Deegan, he would operate a store at Dillingham. Gordon Jensen from Petersburg. Dick Jansen from Cordova. It was sort of a varied group. I was the first troller that ever served on the Board of Fish and Game. And I think I'm the only one. I wouldn't swear to that, but I don't know of any others. It was educational. I enjoyed a lot of it. I didn't enjoy the politicking. There was just a lot of politicking going on. And that sort of irritated me. I felt that if there wasn't a biological reason or some basis for changing a regulation or inserting a new one, too many guys try to buy our services. I felt like I had to sleep at nights by myself. I didn't go for that much.
Do you remember any of the real hot topics? Was there one that kind of stuck out?
Probably the hottest topic, the one that we had more arguments over, and wound up being nothing, was on the game board meetings. But there was a proposal came in to open the season for one district there near Anchorage for hunting big game animals with a crossbow. Actually, the first time it came up, we went round and round and round about that, and finally it got voted down, and that was it. The next year we came back, and there was another proposal in for the same thing. And that time, we persuaded enough that we passed it. And I believe to this day that's still in effect. But Doc Romig from Anchorage, he just hated that. And he got up and he walked around the table there and he was practically screaming. When we finally voted on it, he seen he was going to lose the vote. He wanted to take a recess. But he just got up and he started politicking. He went around and around and talked to everybody and he seen that he was going to lose. And he says, I don't give a damn what you guys do. You could pass a regulation that they can go out and kill polar bears with a sock full of shit. You'd vote for it. He says, but you go ahead. I'm not going to vote for it. And, oh, geez, he was mad. But he lost. You know, the next year came back, and he gave a speech. He says, you know, I want to know what all this excitement was of hunting with a crossbow. He says, well, I'll tell you. I joined a club, crossbow club. I got me a crossbow. I took some lessons. You know, he says, and I went out hunting with a crossbow. I shot a big game animal with a crossbow. You know, gentlemen, I never had so much fun in my life. He was a confirmed crossbow hunter, and he put up such a fight for that thing, and he had the whole board just chomping at the bit. You know, are we doing the wrong thing? And everybody was just fighting with themselves. It finally passed the second year, and the biggest opponent wound up that he just loved it. There were several pretty hot meetings. One was on a big game guide. Oscar Dyson, he was just about as mad as Doc Romig was over the crossbow hunting. He wouldn't even go to dinner with any of us. He went on his own. But the next year, it's all different.
Now, were the meetings all held in one location, or did you move around the state?
We had one meeting a year in Juneau, and that was under the regulations. But the other meetings were held in Kodiak. We had meetings in Sitka, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Ketchikan. So we moved around the state quite a bit. I got to travel all over the country and meet a lot of different people, mostly good people. A lot of them didn't have the same idea as I did, but they were still pretty good people, you know. We had moved all over the state, and we one game meeting would be maybe like in Ketchikan and the fishery meeting in Kodiak, but we had one board meeting a year in Juneau, and then the rest of them we traveled.
So when it was all over, did you think it was a positive experience, or by then were you kind of burned out and ready to be over?
Well, it was a new experience every time. Like, you get up in the interior, and their problems up there is real to them. It's pretty far-fetched for me. But to sit and discuss it with them people, and you know it was coming from the heart most of the time, and you try to understand it as best as possible. Most of the time, you wound up sympathizing, and you could see their problems. The same thing, and I'd say Gene Miller from Fairbanks. We had problems down here with the commercial fishing. It was a far removed from him. But I went to dinner several evenings with Jeannie, and he picked my brain on it, what the problems were, how'd they arise, and what's the cause of it. And then he'd make an educated vote on the proposal, and most of the time he was pretty well versed on it by the time we got through. So it was a new experience every time you went to a different community. For me, it was sort of exhilarating. I really enjoyed it because I loved hunting, fishing, trapping, and the wildlife. And to be with people far removed from my way of life, but they were doing the same thing. They were hunting and trapping and fishing, but they did it a little differently. So it was pretty exhilarating.
Well, it sounds to me like you guys were all picked for a reason, and that is you had open minds and you were willing to consider all angles on the topic and come to an informed decision.
You know, I could never really tell you why Governor Egan picked me. I met Governor Egan. I was at a couple of meetings when he was there, and I went to dinner with him one time. So he never ever asked me if I'd want to serve on the board until just prior to him appointing me, he wrote a letter. It said he was considering me to go on the board, and if he appointed me, would I accept? And I said, yes, sure, I would accept.
I imagine that when you opened that letter, that was kind of a surprise.
It was a shock. It was totally out of the blue. I had no idea that he wanted to appoint me to the board. Mm-hmm. In fact, on the wall up there is my certificate of the state of Alaska. Yep. I had dinners with him after that, and we talked, and he was just a regular guy. He grew up the hard way, too. So we had a lot in common, I think. I had quite a varied life. It was 53 years ago, and I was running a cannery tender packing fish from Dry Bay. That's up on the coast just on this side of Yakutat. The boat was the Italio. It was owned by Libby McNeil and Libby. You don't hear Libby anymore, but they had canneries all over Alaska, up in Bristol Bay and South Central and Prince William Sound, all over. But a couple of the biggest canneries in Alaska, I think, was Taku Harbor, just south of Juneau. It was seven canning lines in it. And then they had one at Yakutat up there, was 2.5 line. But Libby was quite a large company. The last cannery they operated in Alaska was in George Inlet, that's just south of Ketchikan, close to the Canadian border. In 1952, I took the Alitalia south. I had to stop in George Inlet and pick up a lot of the equipment. They were ready to closing down. Then I commercial fished a lot, but I also went back to my trapping and hunting in the fall and winter time. So that's what kept me here, is just love of the hunting and fishing, and very familiar with the whole country and some of the hot spots were. So when your roots is someplace, it's hard to pull them and move, you know.
One thing I guess I wanted to ask is whether you had any comments about agency personnel, people like Fish and Game or Fish and Wildlife Protection, good experiences, bad experiences, folks you really admired, that sort of thing.
Well, I've heard a lot of guys say they were either treated badly, but I myself have never been treated bad, I don't think, by any of them. Some of my good friends, like Buck Stewart. Buck Stewart was the head of enforcement for the state of Alaska in the late 60s and early 70s. He had his own plane, and he'd come out, and he and I went hunting together many times. He was just a real good friend of mine, but he never pulled rank on me, and I never asked for a favor from him. We were just friends.
Mutual respect.
Right. So I've had a lot of good experiences with them, and I've had some come and ask me what I thought about something. I give my honest opinion, whether right or wrong, you know, but I never try to influence them.
You know, it's been a great session here. Is there anything you'd like to say, kind of to summarize what this outdoor lifestyle has meant to you throughout your life?
Well, I just feel bad that I'm getting to the point in my life when I can't enjoy all the things I used to. But I think what bothers me more than anything is to look at the hills around here that's being logged off and know that pretty near every one of them I've packed deer off of, hunted on, trapped on. And I can think back just many real fun times that I've had in there. I guess it's sort of sad. I can think of all the young people coming up that are never going to have the experiences I had living close to Mother Earth, you know.
That wraps up our interview with Adam Greenwald of Huna. I hope you enjoyed listening to him as much as I did. He was an expert outdoorsman and a true gentleman. Tune in again next week when we'll hear stories from another veteran outdoorsman on Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.